Good afternoon. The House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Representative Marquardt, would you like to move the minutes from the last meeting?
Madam Chair, I'll so move the minutes.
Thank you. Any questions or comments about the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. And I just wanted to do a special recognition. First of all, we have many wonderful staff people that help us accomplish our work here. And so Jordan Foster is here today. Jordan, I'm sorry to embarrass you. Would you stand up? Jordan is a research assistant for our nonpartisan staff, and she's done what I've been told is amazing work all session. And she went to Concordia Moorhead, correct? And she's a Humphrey School grad student getting her master's degree. So thank you so much, Jordan, for all your great work. And Tim, Mr. Strom wanted me to note that she's not responsible for any drafting errors by Mr. Strom in this session. So really not. Anyway, thank you very much. So with that, our order of business is House File 4328 today. And so I will move that House File 4328 be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. And I move the 4328DE2 amendment. And so now the bill and the DE2 amendment is before us. All right, and open to amendments. And we do have amendments that were filed, and so the A-17 amendment, Representative Marquardt, I believe that is yours.
Yes.
So the A-17 amendment, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members. I'd like to move the A-17, or did you already move the A-17?
You go ahead and move
okay,
it.
Okay, I'll move the A-17 amendment.
All right, to your amendment, Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, members, and we actually saw this bill in committee last week. It's Representative Knobloch's bill that creates a special education equity aid. And as we all know, but you know, maybe members of the audience, is that schools are mandated by state and federal law to provide an education to students with special needs and disabilities. That is required and mandated by law. And they assume some pretty big costs in doing that. And they have to fulfill those obligations and they have to fulfill those costs. And the reimbursement that is received from the federal government and the state, as we all know, is short of those required costs. And yet they have to provide those costs in some shape, way, or manner. So what they have to do is take those funds from other areas within their educational, in their school districts, basically out of other areas of the classroom to make sure they're fulfilling that mandated requirement. And that's called the cross-subsidy. And what that cross-subsidy is doing, it's actually increasing classroom sizes and number of kids in classes because they're having to pull dollars out of those areas. But it's also making it more difficult to achieve state goals like the achievement gap and closing that and so forth. And so what this bill does, very quickly, it divides the state into two regions. And one region is the metro area and basically any other district that has 7,500 or more pupil units, and then the rest is greater Minnesota with less than 7,500. So there's two averages, and it takes two averages, and then it says whatever the regional average is versus what your actual cost is, you will be reimbursed the lesser of $120 per pupil or the 30% in that gap. And so the dollars are distributed out that way. It would cost about $20 million. Bill is set up so the costs are into the tails, into the next biennium. So basically, it'd be $20 million probably out of reserves. And that would be about 1% of the reserves. And I think if you were to ask parents and school district officials and school board officials and so forth, if it's taking 1% out of the general fund reserve or starting to get a good head start, on getting this cross-subsidy and starting to fund and catch up with this special ed, which has a huge impact on our entire school districts, I think they would take this proposal here. And I know, Madam Chair, the number one goal is certainly the safe schools, as your bill has in it. But I do think we heard from testifiers throughout the year that when it comes to the financing point, that this special education piece was probably the next most important financial piece that I heard folks say. So, members, with that, I would ask for members' support. And I, Madam Chair, I would ask for a roll call on this amendment.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Any further comments or debate? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Marquardt, thank you for bringing this forward. You know, we are in an odd situation. This is a conservative amendment. This is Representative Knobloch's good work. He recognizes, while he's looking for places where he can, where perhaps we could lower the cost of special education services, he recognizes that the cost of special education services is a burden on a number of districts. And their ability to deliver the sort of other services that students needs, students need, families want, and the workforce desires. The strength of this approach in looking at the special education cross subsidy is it's not speculative, it's not projections, it's not forecasts. It's based on reimbursing districts for actual expenses that they are incurring. That's all that this is asking for, and it's putting it off until the next biennium so that it's built in. That stability facilitates good planning by districts. Districts need a horizon that they can look towards. Right now, they don't have that when it comes to special education funding. And I think parents are getting savvier. You see that in West Virginia. You see it in Kentucky. You see it in Oklahoma. They are getting more savvy to the underfunding of schools. They're seeing, I just recall a few years ago talking to a mom whose kids were in the same district she was in as a child and saying, my kids get less opportunity than I did as a kid in this district. And in fact, my younger kids get less opportunity than my older kids did in the same district. Parents are getting savvier. They want a solution on school funding. I'm sure we see that building here, and I appreciate you bringing this forward. It's a solid proposal. I'd urge people to vote yes.
And Representative Sansi.
I just want to share with members how important this cross-subsidy issue is. Not my district, but in the Duluth schools just this year, there was such an issue that occurred with the cross-subsidy. Districts can't budget for how many students are going to be coming or going or how they're going to be impacted. And that district faced such a dire financial situation, they were asking superintendents, administrative staff, teachers, support staff to take unpaid days of work to volunteer their time just in order to make their school run, to keep the budget semi-balanced. It was so upside down. And we have to acknowledge that this is a real situation, and we have to do what we can for our districts to help them, but also ultimately for our students. And I think this really helps at getting at that. This is becoming everybody's story across our state. And this was just an astronomical, unplanned budget interference with dire effects. So I think this is really good stuff.
Thank you, Representative Sinstead. Representative Marquardt, and obviously this is a very important topic. We've had a number of hearings on special education, both trying to sort out the new formula change that was implemented in 2013-14 and what that means now. And unfortunately, even with those changes, our cross-subsidy has grown even more. So, even with an infusion of money in that. So I do think that the efforts of the working group, which is another component in this bill, is very important. We've got to find a way to understand the factors contributing to this, and what, if anything, we can do to try to control the growth and the spending in this area, and if we're serving our special ed students the best that we can with the laws that we have. But I think you're raising an important point. And so I know you wanted a roll call. I'm happy to accept the amendment if that's all right with you, or do you want to move forward with the roll call?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. No, I'll withdraw okay. the roll call.
All right. And so I would accept the amendment. So any other debate or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the A-17 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A-17 amendment is adopted. All right. And Representative Mariani, I have you down as the A-4 author.
Madam Chair, I would so move.
All right. Representative Mariani moves the A-4 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, as members know, last year we created a new licensing teacher licensure framework in the state based on a tier system. So we have four tiers. That only begins to describe what we did. There were a number of important reforms that had to do with, in my opinion, had to do with loosening up. That's the wrong word. Had to do with expanding the door by which we can get good, solid, competent professionals in our classrooms. It was a heavily fought battle. In the end, there was some level of bipartisan support on the bill. I supported the bill, even though I had continued to have some reservations with some elements of the new structure. Probably not unusual when you do something that big. However, there is an issue here, and a number of us perhaps not strongly enough raised this issue last year as we were moving the bill forward. It had to do with questioning the timeline by which we were expecting this new licensing system to be implemented. As difficult as shifting to a new system is, that difficulty was added by the fact that we also changed the board under which whose responsibility it is to do this. And so that board became, we went from the Board of Teaching January 1st of this year, becomes the PALSBY board. I'm not even going to attempt to recall the acronyms on it. And then there was a shifting of responsibilities from Department of Ed onto this new board. That's a short way of saying that that's a really big lift in a very short period of time that I think made it clear to a number of us that the concerns that some of us had last year about the timing, the July of this year, timing for the to have all the rules in place so that this board can then issue with confidence respond to applicants for licensing under this new system was just not realistic. Nonetheless, the board has been working feverishly to meet that timeline. When I got back, and Madam Chair, I was delayed. I was out last week at a national conference in Chicago, and as much as I miss being in Minnesota, I didn't mind being stuck in Chicago for 2 days. Apparently, we all had a bad blizzard here. What I learned when I got back is that the board had a meeting that very weekend. There were members that drove in from greater Minnesota and drove back, something that people probably shouldn't have been doing over the weekend. And it's just really a testament, I think, to these citizen volunteers who are providing much-needed service for us to carry out the legislator's will, that they're working hard. Nonetheless, what I'm told is that this board is not going to be able to make this July 1st deadline. You just simply can't squeeze blood out of a turnip. And although they've made great progress, and I think within a matter of several months, they may well be in place to, depending on what the ALJ response is to the most recent rules. So all this amendment does then basically is to give that board the time that it needs to be able to complete the process that we've asked them to do, that has bipartisan support, that's an exciting new chapter in our state, and it's vitally important for us to get this right, Madam Chair. The possible worst downside of not getting it right is litigation against the state. Someone gets denied, a license. They think it's, it was a wrong decision, and it was done under incomplete rules. There are plenty of clever attorneys out there, I think, that can make hay out of that. Not a good way for us to start a big shift in our licensing process. So this this amendment would give them the time to be able to do that work. It's really as simple as that. And frankly, I don't think this is a partisan issue. I'd be interested to hear, what the discussion is on the committee. And so my preference would be not to do a roll call here in the spirit of bipartisanship. But I think it's so important that if, in fact, there's going to be opposition to doing something this vitally important, then I would ask for a roll call. But, Madam Chair, I'll hold to see what comments there might be from committee members here.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mariani. And I'm going to defer largely to Representative Erickson because I know this was much the product of the policy committee, and I know this was discussed as well. I do have concerns about delaying implementation for an entire year. I have to say up front, this is a licensure system that works is something that has been sorely needed for a long time in Minnesota, and I know it was a long time coming in the development of the product and with the help of the OLA report and a lot of really hard work by members on this committee that serve on the policy committee and others. So, and so I think, I have concerns about a year-long delay, but I would like to call on Representative Erickson to share her thoughts about this as well, because I know this topic was debated, I think, probably at length in the policy markup as well. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have met just this week with the interim director and the government liaison from PALSB, which is our Professional Educators Licensing and Standards Board. And I think they're doing really good work on a tight timeline. They think right now at the latest it'll be August. So I think it behooves us to move forward with the present implementation date of July 1, 2018.
All right, thank you, Representative Erickson. Any other thoughts or comments from committee members? Representative Murphy, did you seek recognition? Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, thank you. What if they don't make it?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. They'll issue licenses one way or another.
Representative Sandstead.
I met with members of the PELSB board who came to my office to say, we need time. And I think it's really important that we consider this seriously when the professionals are saying, we can't do this in the time frame we've been directed to do this in. We really need to listen to that, and we need to recognize them as the professionals. I think it's frustrating for us that maybe things don't happen in the time frame we want it to happen, but there's always a cost to doing something too quickly, and I think there's a lot of opportunity with the new licensing system. I want to make sure that it rolls out smoothly, that we don't have to come back and do fixes that we often see happening. And I know it's not a perfect analogy, but if we went to our dentist and said, you have 15 minutes or 20 minutes to do a root canal, because we're directing you that You have to do that, and we believe you can do it in that time. I certainly don't want to be the first person to sign up for that. And it's, again, not the perfect analogy, but when they are telling us professionally, we just can't get this done in this time frame, we need more time, I believe it is our job to listen to those experts and give them that time. It's frustrating, but it's more important that we get it right.
Thank you. Representative Erickson, did you want to comment again?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. These rules were essentially written by last November. That means they had already spent a good 6 months writing them. They had met with several of us stakeholders for revisions. We continue to offer revisions. The problem is they did not reconstitute as soon as they were reorganized in January, and so they have brought on their own delays. So, Madam Chair, I think that we proceed with this effective date, and I think that Pelsby is hearing from us that we expect them to be ready as soon as possible. If that is August, I think they can make some adjustments to issue licenses, but I'm hoping that August, as Mr. Luisi mentioned to me the other day in my office, is a great date to expect.
Thank you. Representative Sinstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not even going to argue, you know, whether they've brought this on themselves or not, but I have been hearing consistently through the process they need more time, and now we need to ask, who is this going to impact? It's going to impact the teachers that we're looking to put in the classrooms because we have a shortage. If we get it wrong, we've accomplished nothing. If we give them the time they need and we get it right, then we have an avenue to fixing what has already clearly been defined as a problem.
Representative Moriarty.
Madam Chair, and I certainly know human nature, and I know we all get stubborn. I can be pretty darn stubborn myself. Sometimes that works out for me here. Oftentimes it actually doesn't. This is not about the Pelsby Board. This is about our law. This is our time. This is our issue. As someone, quite frankly, who stuck his neck out a little bit on this issue, it's important for me that we get this right. And to get it wrong because we're going to be stubborn about not recognizing the reality that this board ran into, it's just not a good way to be able to, or it's not a good way to do good public policy. The issue with the year really has to do with districts making those assignments under this new system, and the sooner that they know. So if August works out, you know, that'd be great. But if we're into, you know, September, October, November, and they're going to wind up with all sorts of folks contending the decision at the district about why I got why I didn't get offered a position or I got offered a position under a quote-unquote flawed licensing system because the rules are incomplete, then we're basically saying we don't care about this tier licensing system when, in fact, we do. And so to me, it's, you know, this is really a no-brainer. It's, there's no, you know, attempt on my part to undo something that I stuck my neck out for, you know, by giving this board the time that it needs to do. The issue here is that we don't know what the administrative law judge is going to say about the rules that they are, I think, just submitted as a result, or will be submitting as a result of the incredible time that they've been putting in. It may well be that August may work. That's still beyond this July deadline, but it may well be that the ALJ will come back and say, hey, you got to address these three issues, so go right back and draft it up again. And under Minnesota law, we have to be able to provide that public period of time to review and comment. So I just don't know why we're even having this debate. Madam Chair, is it? I apologize because I don't remember your rules here. You know, if August or September date is doable or acceptable for folks to move on this thing, would the chair and this committee be amenable to amending this amendment to reflect that?
Well, Representative Mariani, because we are, this is already a second degree amendment, to the, so we have an amendment to the DE2. We really can't amend these at this point. And what I'd like to say about this is that, you know, I have concerns about the year, which I have already expressed. And it's my understanding that the administrative law judge, the chief, did determine that the required rulemaking could be accomplished. Now, we know that there's, we were all trying to make our best guesses at the pace of the work and what will happen. But there is still a little time in this session to address this. I mean, whatever the product that moves out of this committee and to the floor, we're going to have a conference with the Senate. And I will tell you that I will pledge to be reasonable and receptive to language if we need to include that to allow more time. I would, like I said, I think a year is probably too much, but I would be open to continuing to discuss that and that if, you know, a final product before we would send something to the governor if we can come to some agreement on that. My mind is open on that.
Well, Madam Chair, my political instincts that tells me to ask for a roll call on this issue simply because it's important to be on, for the public to be on the record who is approaching this from a particular perspective. I'm going to work against my public or my my political instinct at this point because we still have a stop on the floor, and hopefully that will give us some more time between now and then. To find out what the ALJ is going to do. So I'm not interested in playing political games here is what I'm saying. So I won't ask for a roll call at this point. I do want a voice vote on this. And I'll continue to work with Chair Erickson and yourself and the department, or rather the board. And if we're still in an impasse, we'll have this discussion on the House floor.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that very much, Representative Mariani. And, you know, we all have a lot invested in this. A lot of us are kind of all in this boat together with regards to the big reform that we made and creating one entity and trying to make sure that we've got a thoughtful licensure process that works. And so none of us want to see this fail because of lack of time or hurried implementation. I would absolutely agree with that. So, again, as I said, I'm just not ready to say right now that an entire another year is necessary. But let's keep talking about this, and I would appreciate very much to continue talking with you about this in particular. So, thank you. So, any other comments before we go to vote on the A4 amendment? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The nays have it. The amendment is not adopted. All right. A14 amendment, Representative Kreisha, I believe that is yours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, as I've been looking at this language, there's two things that came out at me, and I just want to position them. Number one is I come from the world of small software providers. I'll give you a good example. When I was in the schools teaching digital media, our kids would actually create software packages, and then they would sell those to other schools, and they would donate those money to the local charities. And what happened under this language, those classrooms would now become technology providers. And I'll give you a good example. One of the solutions that we solved was we created some educational learning software, and our kids sold it to another school, and we had to enter in the kids' usernames because it helped. Well, that's public data. And every time our kids would have had to touch that data or help enter those usernames, even though it was just first name, last initial, under this they would have had to log all that. And suddenly you start to create this unwielding environment for small software innovations like that. Another thing is we see a lot of software come out of classrooms like Oregon Trail, for example. If you think back, those were created by teachers who were looking to get into this and use their experience. So that was one problem that I had with this is puts the technology directors, which can be small software providers and entrepreneurs, in a tough spot. The other thing is there's an inherent inconsistency, and I just want to point it out real quick. Line 126 that I think has to be cleaned up before we move forward with data like this. And I'm sorry, I forget the line number. It was 120. Get my DE amendment out. Oh, here it is.
Can you tell us the page number?
Yep. I'm sorry. Page number 125. Oh, excuse me. Page number 126. Lines 126.21 to line 126.24. The way this is written now, it does cause a conflict that would have to be resolved, and that is we're saying here that any of these log of use information would have to be held for 1 year. However, up on line 126.11 and 126.14, we're saying that if somebody chooses not to renew, the clock starts ticking. So the problem is on the 29th day of a 30-day renewal, if you decide not to renew with a company and then you say, send me all your data, that is an interaction with that data that now do we have to, does that software provider have to hold that for a year? So I think that needs to be cleared up as well. So in order, rather than take these into an inconsistency and hold the entrepreneurs back, I am asking for a delete of that language, 126.21 to 126.24, members and Madam Chair.
So, and that is your amendment?
That is my amendment.
All right. Any questions for Representative Crescia on his amendment? Representative Dabney.
You know, Madam Chair, when I got home the other night, there was mail sitting for me, and it was from a credit card company explaining that my data had been breached. You know, it's kind of oobla-dee oobla-da. Life goes on at this point with data breaches. But under state and federal law, they notified me. They don't have somebody sitting there watching each individual account. It's automated. And they're able to tell that our data had been breached. My wife and I actually got identical letters. This language establishes a standard that's already extends in the industry. You got to know who's logging in. You got to know what they're seeing. When you log in, you use a password and username, and that identifies who just logged in and who's accessing the data. If I get a letter when somebody's accessed my data at a bank or a credit union or a credit card company, I think we should be able to track the data on our kids, especially when it's being used potentially for commercial purposes or abused for commercial purposes. This simply sets a standard that's out there already. And small internet entrepreneurs know they need to meet certain industry standards. So I would speak in opposition to the Crescia Amendment. I think parents want to know, in this day and age of Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and all of that, they want to know that their kids' data is secure. And if it's not, they want to know what happened and what's going to be done to fix it. Thank you.
Representative Crescia?
Yep, Madam Chair. We do nothing at all. I do not touch the breach language. I agree with all that. All we're simply saying is that law, when someone logs in, yes, we log in the system, but imagine the person that's sitting there. Again, let me take my students. We create the software. We create an Excel spreadsheet. We send that. Now we have to create a log that says we did this on such and such a time. Every single time we open that file, that log has to be created. So the breach and everything that you talk about is not being touched at all. It's still in here. I'm just talking about the burdensome second and third logs that we're creating that will create a burden for small software providers, as well as, like I said, it's inconsistent. Do they keep it for a year? To your point, if I choose not to renew with a company and they now have to keep it for a year and leave it on their servers, that's 365 more days that it could be breached when you've left that company. So I'm actually trying to make it better and to address some of the issues that you're raising, but perhaps you see it differently.
Other comments or discussion? All right. Well, the chair's position, I've had a chance to talk with Representative Creature about this, and I will tell you I have a little less comfort with some of the data language. I don't feel like we spent enough time as a committee discussing these really important issues, honestly. But I do have a concern, especially in the educational space, that we write provisions such that we're only going to have the very largest companies providing services to our schools. And that is something that is of concern. So I have been so persuaded that I'm going to support the A14 amendment. Other discussion? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of the A14 amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
All right. A14 amendment is adopted. A12 amendment, I think that is yours, Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is my amendment. What this amendment does is it's talking about full-service community schools again. And the reason I'm offering this amendment is because I definitely know the one thing that we are all committed to at this table is the students of Minnesota and their well-being. And we've worked very, very hard at talking about how can we as a legislature really support our students in schools, what can we be doing to support our staff, our teachers, education as a whole. And I'm very proud of the work that we've done. Oftentimes I think we go about how we get there from different angles, but our goal is the same. This session we have focused so strongly on school safety and mental health. And without a doubt, those are critically important issues. And what I believe this amendment does is it takes the great work that we've been doing, the intention of what we're trying to do, our students' well-being, and it gives them one more layer of support. Because what we've done is we've looked at buildings and we've looked at what happens inside the walls of our buildings. But as an educator, I can tell you much of what we deal with inside our buildings is a result of what's happening outside of the four walls. And we haven't really been able to get at an effective way on addressing those issues. I believe full-service community schools helps that by assessing each district, each community independently. You don't have a one-size-fits-all. You have specific needs identified within a community. And then you have wraparound services for parents, for families, for communities. So all the great work that happens inside a district, inside a school building, can also be supported outside of that. Oftentimes, we can do great work during the school day, but when our students leave that building, if they don't have the support systems afterwards, we lose a lot of ground. And that's everybody's reality. Somewhere across the state, everywhere across the state, that's everybody's reality, but our situations might look a little bit different. Maybe in one district they have child care needs. Maybe in another district it's health care needs. I don't think it would be a stretch to assume in many districts it's going to be mental health needs outside the school building. And I think full-service community schools get at that and allow for that. So my bill is just a money appropriation in the tails. It's not anything for this year. I think this is an opportunity to offer comprehensive targeted services, again, that wrap around and support the student inside the building and outside of the building, as well as their families. That's it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sandstead. Any comments from other members?
Madam Chair, I'd like to roll call this.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Any further discussion? Representative Sandstead, unfortunately, I am going to oppose your amendment. And I know we've provided some money for community schools in our budget. And I know we've heard testimony on this concept in the past. And actually, other school, this whole concept was started by a school district, and that without any particular appropriation. I know sometimes it does take resources to have someone as sort of spearheading that effort of gathering those community resources and bringing them into the school and having it be a central place where families can come for support that they need. But my hope and my belief is that with the school safety funds that we're providing in this bill and with the range of options we're providing schools and the flexibility, that they may be able to do this with some of these funds as well. I mean, the purposes of safe schools is pretty broad in terms of being able to secure counseling staff or support staff, you name it, in that allowed purposes of that program. And with the infusion of money, $19 million in fiscal year 19 and a lot more in the tails, that this is something if schools want to craft this solution as part of their safety program of supporting students and providing more support, I think that's something they could do. So I am going to oppose the provision of more money, even though it's in the tail. So, but I just wanted you to understand that it's not that I oppose the concept or what's going on in our schools. I just think they're going to have the flexibility, more of them, to do this if they wish with the resources we're providing. Representative Sandstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your candidness on that. And I think it would be a wonderful thing if the money that we've appropriated really can get at all of that. Do you feel confident that the complexity of the dynamics that our students face, the face of today's families, and all of the, again, complexities that come with that, will fall under the, there'll be enough flexibility in those other provisions to get at those, the heart of that, those issues, and support the families, and in supporting the families are also supporting the students?
Representative Sandstead, I do think we're providing a robust package of support to our schools under the broad umbrella that we're calling school safety. And in placing many provisions, many legislative changes to existing programs and more money with those programs, I do think schools are going to have a lot more options and a lot more the ability to do things that maybe they had wanted to do, but the resources just aren't there. And I think in particular for the floor that we're establishing for schools in primarily greater Minnesota with small numbers of students, that is also going to go a long ways towards making sure that they've all got at least a meaningful amount of money to try to address some of these needs. Will we address all the needs? Probably not. And unfortunately, that's something we face, I think, with everything we do in this committee and maybe lots of other priorities within the state. We do the best we can, and I think we are providing, again, a very significant amount of funding to try to help towards this. And so I think we're going to make significant steps forward in that direction. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me also go on record as saying thank you. I agree that you have dedicated quite a bit of money to things that are very, very valuable. So I don't want to overlook that. I just, for conversation, for moving forward to the committee, I really think it would behoove us to start thinking outside the box on how can we help support students outside of the building, not just inside the building. Because I think a lot of what's happening in families and outside in the, you know, after school hours is driving the issues that we're seeing inside our schools. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for staff, Mr. Strom. If a bill were to be dropped next year that did this exact same thing, could we accomplish the exact same timeline by passing this next year?
Mr. Strong.
Madam Chair, Representative Crescia, this appropriation on line 1.6 is first effective for fiscal year 2020, and that the next session of the legislature, 2019, could indeed pass an appropriation for 2020.
Thank you, Mr. Strong.
Any other comments, debate, discussion, questions? All right. Seeing none and a roll call being requested, the clerk will call the roll on the A12 amendment.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Bennett?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Anselmo?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Juergens?
No.
Representative Kreisha?
No.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Sandstedt?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Slocum, Representative Smith, Representative Tyson.
No.
Representative Thiessen and Representative Wills.
No.
All right, there being 6 ayes and 12 nays, the amendment is not agreed to. Thank you, Representative Sandstedt. Representative A, okay, A6 amendment. Is that yours, Representative Mariani?
Madam Chair, that's my amendment. I will so move.
All right, Representative Mariani moves the A6 amendment. To your amendment, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, this has to do with the star rating system that's called for in the bill. And I have to say, I note that in your language, you have a star rating system change, which, frankly, I welcome relative to the language that we start with here in this bill. We had quite a bit of discussion in committee, policy committee, about this. I know we had a hearing here as well. And, just yesterday, we heard a comment from some parents. And Madam Chair, my political instinct again tells me, well, you know, there's some movement here, and you should embrace that, keep moving forward. But I do want to make an important distinction here. We've tried to make this repeatedly throughout the session, and the distinction really is, in my mind, between a summative rating construct versus what I believe is a construct that actually provides relevant information that a parent can immediately work with their parent, with their student. I really think it comes down to that. I've been involved with these summative rating discussions for at least 10 years. When I chaired the committee, it was a hot issue, a decade ago. There was a big movement across the country. There was a lot of pushback subsequent to that. So we've gone back and forth, it seems to me, as a society. What we have done, I think, is that we've gotten better at being able to pull out and tease out and expect our schools and school districts to provide meaningful information to parents, so that at one time, whereas star ratings and letter grades and all those kind of things were sort of the best that we could do, we can do better now. And in fact, in policy committee, we had some discussion about Minneapolis's use of the School Finder, I think it's called. One page, simple, but powerful depiction of a school that includes some of the elements, by the way, that are in the bill and that's in your language here, and also includes other elements that parents find helpful. What it doesn't do is it doesn't then say, through some formula, which none of you understand, because we have these complicated psychometrics, this means that this school is a B. In testimony in the policy committee, we had Spanish-speaking parents, and it was a delight, Madam Chair, to hear testimony in Spanish. Representative Erickson was very gracious to have me be able to respond and ask questions in Spanish of the parents. they testified that they wanted something like this star rating system. I listened carefully to what they said they really wanted, and what they really wanted to know is how is their school working with effectively with their student. And many of those students are non-English speakers. And so I said, well, there's nothing in this bill right now that tells you anything about the effectiveness of your school being able to actually communicate in your home native language, in the language of your student. Isn't that what you want? Well, yes, that is what I want. Representative Peterson, I think, listened carefully and then brought back an amendment that included that element. But the point of that exercise, Madam Chair, members, wasn't to carve out a spot for that one issue, as important as that is. It was really to make the point that there's all sorts of different issues that are important to any given parent in any different situation. And that's what a summative rating system simply is not designed to do. An A, a B, a C, or a D was not going to tell those Spanish-speaking parents how effective their school is in communicating in Spanish with their students. Something like the school public school finder does do that. Fred Nolan, Dr. Fred Nolan of the Minnesota Rural Ed Education Association, testified in committee, and he said, look, here's what the department is doing in constructing a dashboard. And in so many words, he basically said what they're doing is what Minneapolis is doing with this public finder system, which is a one-page with, you know, pictures, graphs, that tells a powerful story about a whole bunch of different things that are important to parents. And right now the department has been engaged and continues to be engaged with all sorts of stakeholders at the table to design that thing so we can get it down to a truly helpful, immediately useful instrument without having to dig through the long report card. I think it's important for the department to finish that dashboard. And I think that it's not about bad intention or anything. The summative rating system just short-circuits that process of the department working with broad stakeholders, listening carefully to what people think is really, truly important, following a process that's a public process. It isn't us here in the legislature with some psychometric. I still have yet to meet the psychometrician who put this current system together. I know you're saying the department now needs to do it. But there's a really open process that's happening right now. And so I think it's important that we allow that to play itself out. I think it's important that the department report back to us about that. And if at that point we're not happy with it, you know, then I think we can come at it a little bit differently. But I do think it's premature for us to expect a summative rating system. It's quite possible the department may have a summative component to their dashboard. We've heard that in testimony. What is not possible, we heard this clearly from the commissioner, is that the instrument will not be an exclusive summative rating instrument. And so, Madam Chair, you know, with that, I just think this is vitally important. We went down this road a decade ago. After only a year or two, we backed out of it and got rid of it. I don't think we need to go back down there again. I think we ought to play out this dashboard possibility that provides folks, parents in particular, with an easily digestible but yet powerful narrative of how their school is doing with their student. And so, Madam Chair, I would encourage support for this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Any other comments from committee members? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your comments, Representative Mariani. I was on the school board when this conversation was brought up, and I was opposed to it at that time as well, because it seemed kind of like more of a scarlet letter type approach instead of, I think, something that we're seeing now is that parents really do want to be empowered. I happened to attend a meeting in St. Paul that was basically a bunch of families of parents of color, and they were very, very frustrated about how they were having a difficult time understanding where their schools are at and how they could improve it. And to be honest, you know, maybe the language didn't get quite to where it needed to be originally. It was a process, and listening to everyone, I personally feel that legislation gets better. In my perfect world, I would prefer to see a dashboard and then all those components be collectively put into a summative rating so that parents can be empowered and they can understand where does my school land in comparison to others, and then have the additional data that could help explain how they got to those numbers, and then also be utilized as a diagnostic tool for school districts to say, wow, we're doing really well here, but in these areas, we need to do some work, and we can focus on that because we have measurable results. We collect more data than just about any other state, but where we put it and how we make it comprehensible, we fail, in my opinion. The department has all this information, and yes, you can access it. However, to dig through the data that it, as it's presented right now, is challenging even for people who are in this room, to be honest, who are dealing with these types of things every single day. So how do we expect, you know, the mom or dad that are just trying to do the best thing for their child, they know what the best thing is for their kids, but they don't know how to get the information. So what do? They go to greatschools.org. And greatschools.org, you can go to, in fact, it's if you're looking for a home, it will be listed on the listing as this is how you can rate your schools, and it is based on one thing, the MCA scores. Terrific. Just one thing, one day for that school, for that student, that one day, how things were for them. And personally, I don't think that schools should be labeled because of one score. And that is what parents have. And then on top of it, you get to, they also have reviews from parents. And what kind of parents are going to probably take the time to go and make a review on their schools? It's probably going to be the ones that aren't very happy or the ones that are ecstatic. So is that really the right information for parents to go and get really good data about their school? I just don't think it is. So that's why this was an attempt to simplify information for parents so that they can be empowered, hopefully provide some diagnostic information for our schools so that they can say, okay, we need to focus on reducing the achievement gap. We need to focus on these areas where we can do better in comparison to the state or in comparison to our peers. Or maybe we can go out and talk to those peers, maybe see, wow, this elementary school is doing phenomenal work with closing the achievement gap. Let's find out what they're doing that we can also incorporate into our school. But we tend to just, you know, keep that information and hold on to it because we're too afraid to be honest with ourselves. So that is really the reason why this was brought forward. We have ESSA now. What has been proposed is everything is aligned with ESSA or the world's best workforce, and we've tried to find sort of that happy compromise that to move us in the right direction. And Chair Loon has, you know, taken it a step further, and I'm not really sure if we adopted this and adopted the other amendment, how that would possibly even work. So that's, I guess, where I'm a little confused on. They say two different things. Maybe the goal is the same, but there's different dates, and you know, I'm not really sure. But I do want to encourage the department to continue to do their work and to recognize that this is important. This is important to be able to communicate with our families, to communicate with school districts in a clear and concise way, because if we don't do it with the actual data that we have already collected where it's actually accurate, some third party is going to do it for you. And I don't think that it's a very good reflection on what our schools is, and I do think it's we should control that conversation because we have the information to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. And just on the procedural question of what would happen if both would pass, because the amendment that I will be proposing is later, if that passed and this passed, then mine would prevail. It's the second passed amendment, just if there's any question about that. So I wanted to cover that. And, you know, Representative Peterson, I wanted to just kind of align myself with your comments, and I want to thank you for your hard work on it. And I think there's a lot of concern about, you know, if you do any kind of a rating system or information, you know, are you including all of the things you should cover? And I don't know that any rating system would and give you the fullest picture. I mean, parents really do need to, you know, you need to, if you're looking for a school for your children, you need to spend time looking at it, touring it, you know, doing your research and your homework, frankly, to figure out if it's the best spot for your child. And I think, you know, parents do that. But at the same time, as Representative Peterson noticed, I've commented on this topic at other meetings with education folks before. If you think there aren't summative rating systems out there, just go look for a house. Look at any realtor site. Realtor.com rates our schools. It's a 1 through 10 green light, yellow light, red light as to the schools that service a house you may be looking at. They're out there. And I would like to make sure that we are providing with our best possible data, accurate information for parents. It may not be everything, but at the same time, and I know we talk a lot about the cyclometricians and the tests and that, but the MCA tests are the one tests that our kids take that are aligned to the state standards of what we are telling schools that they have to teach to our children, and we measure those standards. We are required to under federal law and also our state law. So, I don't think we should shy away from the notion of summative rating. And I'll save the rest of my comments to my amendment about what I'm offering is what I hope will be a midway point, too, between what's in the DE and where the commissioner is, or maybe where you are, Representative Mariani, with the dashboard. But I wanted to have the benefit of my thoughts on this at this point. So other committee discussion. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to I do appreciate your effort with your amendment. I do want to push forward with this. And I want to be real clear here that as I listen to Representative Peterson, this is not a question of intent, or questioning intent, rather. Pretty much everything you said, I probably have said in public as well. And I've witnessed, in fact, that frustration you talked about, particularly when my kids were in school and I went to the conferences. There's so much that we could be doing, including, quite frankly, training teachers, at least the ones I saw back then, you know, on how to be much better connectors with parents. I mean, I saw some really atrocious behavior with some teachers interacting with Black parents, non-English-speaking parents. That was just totally unprofessional, to say the least. It seems to me that, Madam Chair, what we ought to be doing is investing a lot of resources in helping to build up the skills of our parents so that they, in fact, can powerfully be able to use the data that we're generating nowadays. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, we weren't doing this. We weren't generating, maybe even 10 years ago, for that matter. Now there's a wealth of information there, and I think part of what's motivating all of us is how do we make that accessible and usable for regular folks. And one way at that is to create some kind of a tool that will help parents to do that. Another way is let's help develop the skills of parents to be able to, know what the most pertinent, powerful questions and ways to interact and information on what that means. And I think wherever you find really good parent training groups across the state, that's precisely what they do. But it's hit or miss all over the state. At any rate, that's not what we're doing in this bill. We're not investing in parent development. I do think that the summative rating approach is a slippery slope. This is not about the intent. It's a slippery slope methodologically that actually prevents us from doing what we should be doing, which is, in fact, to invest in parents and invest in better PD with our teachers and our administrators to be able to get information across effectively. It's about the right information. And, again, I've stretched my mind to figure out how an A or a B or a C is going to powerfully inform all these parents that came and testified who spoke specifically about their student. And I know that they were arguing for some kind of rating system, but everything in their testimony was about, I need to know how my student is doing. And I just can't connect the some of the rating, numbering or coloring system to that kind of powerful information. So, Madam Chair, I would encourage us to vote for this, and I'd ask for a roll call.
You'd ask for a roll call? All right. Roll call has been requested. Any other debate or discussion? All right. Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll, call the roll on the A6 amendment.
Representative Loon?
No.
Representative Bennett?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Anselmo?
No.
Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Juergens?
No.
Representative Cresha?
No.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Sandstead?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Slocum? Representative Smith? Representative Tice?
No.
Representative Thiessen? Representative Wills?
Right, there being 5 ayes and 12 noes, the amendment is not adopted. A11 amendment, I think that's yours as well, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I'm on a roll.
You're on a roll, that's right.
I would offer the A11 amendment.
All right, Representative Mariani offers the A11 amendment. To your amendment.
Madam Chair, this... this has to do with language that was added as we were putting together the policy bill before moving to here. And Representative McQuaid, who's a member of that committee, of the policy committee, introduced an amendment that would require consent education as part of the health standards component of instructional guidance that we offer and expect schools to pursue in properly preparing students on a number of important health issues. There was a bit of debate in committee about I think it was a fair debate about what's the best way to frame this issue up. And there was some sense that the best way to do this is to frame it up in law depicting sexual assault, abuse, et cetera. And there's some logic to that. The issue, I think, and I think this is really kind of a pivotal moment for us as a society. We're seeing it, quite frankly, with, I believe, with the incredible growth of the Me Too movement, which is long overdue in our society, but I think reflects how we're understanding the holistic nature of oppression, of negative behavior that has diminished at least half of our population by dehumanizing people based on partly based on gender, but also partly based on what we have all complicitly, perhaps quietly, accepted as what is the norm behavior among human beings. And so what Representative McQuay is trying to do is really getting at that unfortunate normed, in my opinion, normed expectation in our society that basically says that it's okay to insist for one person to insist on another person that one's sexual desires relative to that person should be acknowledged and complied regardless of what the person who is the object of that desire, if you will, feels. This is a conditioning process that begins early, like everything else in our society. And so what Representative Quay did was to take this issue beyond expecting that every individual learn the skills to be able to reject unwanted advances, as important as that skill is. That what she's arguing is, and I think what the Me Too movement is arguing is, that it's everyone's responsibility. Everyone's responsibility to have respectful relationships with one another, to understand the mutuality of our existence with one another, and that the burden shouldn't be, therefore, on the person who's facing an unwanted advance solely. The issue really should be, how do we prepare all our, especially young people, to demonstrate healthy, respectful interactions with one another. So that's the big shift that Representative May Quaid is doing with her amendment. And unfortunately, the language that then shifted away from her approach that's in the bill, I'm not going to argue against it's important for people to learn how to quote-unquote defend themselves. But frankly, we need to do more than that. We've been doing that for a long time, and there are powerful messages in our society, as exhibited by some of the most powerful people, Congress folks, for God's sake, in our society, who even in an environment where that's, you know, the expectation, nonetheless continue to play out what I think is a very unhealthy, I think we all agree, is a very unhealthy norm. So here's our opportunity to be able to work with our young people early on and not just teach them that you can do whatever you want if the person doesn't have the skills to defend themselves, to come at this from a whole different way. That you have a responsibility. Here's what a healthy relationship looks like. Here's what consent looks like. Here's what healthy consent looks like. And it's our expectation as your elders, responsible for your public education, to teach you that powerful central concept of existing with others in our society. So this is really, I think Representative May Quay really put forward a very powerful amendment. We backed off of it in the current bill before us, and I want us to get back to where she is. And I honestly, I don't see why this would not be a unanimous decision on our part for us to be the leaders in our state to move forward our people around, you know, what the healthy norm ought to be and how we can start training and teaching our young people on what that is.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mariani. Any other discussion or comments? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if staff could inform us, what is current state law as far as sex education in the public schools?
Ms. Farah?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, health standards are generally left to the district. There is a statute on sexually transmitted diseases that I would have to pull up to be more specific than that. And I'm happy to do that.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it's basically left right now, largely it's left up to the local school districts then, is what you're saying?
Representative Scott, that's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And so, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Representative Scott.
Representative Mariani, how soon would you foresee teaching this in the public schools?
Representative Mariani. And Art, go ahead. I'll let you respond.
Madam Chair and Representative, quite frankly, as soon as possible.
Kindergarten?
Madam Chair and Representative, you'll allow me to finish. The language here at this point is not mandatory language. We're opening the door. We're beginning here. I think I know where you're going with it, and which is why we have the original construct of local control, so that you have, you know, these discussions locally about what is the appropriate connection and relationship with our community standards. None of that is going to be affected by this. You know, the point is that our broad expectation is that our school districts move toward this approach as opposed to the flawed approach that I identified earlier.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I didn't hear the last. You said, I couldn't hear what you said on part of it. You're a little ways from the mic. But you said something about prefer this approach versus something, and I didn't catch what you said there.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I'll speak louder. What I framed up earlier is that our approach, and I'm doing it generally and simply, but I think it is true, our approach relative to any of these issues and the direction we're moving is, how do we train folks to defend themselves, to resist advances, when the big begging question is, why do those advances exist in the first place? And so the shift here in terms of helping helping our young people to create healthy norms is to engage with them about relationships that are not based on whether you're getting resistance to your advances, but relationships that are based on your respectful, healthy understanding of what a healthy relationship ought to be. Not subject to whether or not you could prevail over someone. It's really subject to having a healthy relationship with that person, where there's mutual responsibility and mutual respect.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm not comfortable with this, even if it's not a mandate. I think this should be left up entirely to local units, to our local school boards and their consultation with parents. And I would hate to think that some school would take this and be teaching this to really young children whose little minds are just not equipped to even have a conversation like this. And so I'm going to oppose this. Thank you.
Other comments or discussion? Representative Mariani.
That's right. I'd like a roll call.
All right. Representative Mariani has asked for a roll call. Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wasn't going to speak. But the roll call prompts me to do this, and that is, one of the things that we know about sexual predators is they build trust. And we start putting things into place, and we give teachers that shouldn't be doing this the ability for them to have conversations about their boyfriends, their girlfriends. And we had predators that we've seen in principals, and they use these opportunities to prey on our kids. They use these opportunities to have these conversations and to open these up. And unfortunately, the principal, like we saw up in Bemidji and these other sexual predators, I've been in the schools, we've heard the stories, we've seen them, we know what's true. They start interjecting into a student's personal lives in places they shouldn't be and build trust and end up in the back seat with that teacher down the road. And that's why I'm incredibly uncomfortable with this. I do not want to give these very horrible people one more opportunity to say, let's talk about your boyfriend or your girlfriend. Sitting on the edge of your desk at the end of the school day having an inappropriate conversation with a high school girl or a high school boy is going to lead that person into trouble. And so I understand the conversations around this, but I also understand the reality of what I've seen in schools, and I've seen too many coaches and too many teachers having inappropriate conversations with 16, 17, 18-year-old girls that should have never happened under the guise of, let's talk about your boyfriend, or let's talk about your relationship, or let's talk about your sex life. And I think that's fine if we want to roll call this, we're going to put here, I think this is an incredibly slippery slope that our schools should not be considering. So as you think about your roll call, think about that person that's going to have that conversation with a young girl that he shouldn't have.
Representative Mariani.
I'm trying not to drag out the debate, so I'll be really brief. You know, Representative Khrushchev, if you look on lines 35.14 and 15 in the bill, it talks about techniques to recognize and to reject unwanted advances. It sounds like that could be a slippery slope as well. The broader construct here is that there's no mandate here. At some point, we're going to have our professionals who are licensed pursue the policies that we expect them to pursue, and they should pursue those in a professional way. Are there folks that can slip in anywhere in that system, whether it's in the language that Representative Makeway provided or the language that's currently in the bill? Possibly. But to argue that this language is the big open door to all sorts of abuse, making it easier, is totally wrong. And so I just reject that argument, and I really would encourage you, all of us, you know, to really wrestle with how do we shift the norm in our society.
Representative Krishna?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mariani, if I misconstrued, I don't believe there's a causation here. I don't believe this language will cause that. But what I am saying is there are adults that will have inappropriate conversations and they will use it to build trust. And unfortunately, when that adult gets the door open with a child, and these are children, they abuse it and they use it and they manipulate. I'm not talking about reasonable people having healthy conversations. I'm talking about people that are using manipulative efforts. I'm just saying there's an ugly side to having these conversations. And when we draft language in this building, we are altering behavior. And we are opening the doors for lots of things. I would never say this is a causation, but I would never be so naive to say this couldn't be used inappropriately and manipulatively by people that I've seen do horrible things. Those are my points.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to point out, Representative Mariani mentioned that the language in the bill talks about strategies and techniques to recognize and reject unwanted advances. But unfortunately, the way the amendment is drafted, if we adopted the amendment, that language would be deleted. and replace with the consent language, which is concerning to me because I do think that language is very important to have in the bill to help students recognize when those inappropriate advances are occurring, how to address that, how to reject those advances. And with the amendment, that language would be lost. So just something for us to consider as we're voting on this.
Thank you, Representative Wells. Any other comments? All right. The clerk will take the roll.
Representative Loon.
No.
Representative Bennett.
No.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Anselmo.
No.
Representative Erickson.
No.
Representative Juergens.
Aye.
Representative Cresha.
No.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Marquardt.
No.
Representative Moran. Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Polston?
No.
Representative Sandstrom?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Slocum? Representative Smith? Representative Tice?
No.
Representative Thiessen? Representative Wills?
No.
All right, there being five ayes and 13 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Okay. Have the A-10 amendment, and I know there was an alternative version drafted with some corrections. Representative Dabney, did you want to offer that? We have copies of that available if you wish.
Madam Chair, I have not yet seen that amendment. What I'm aware of is that stakeholders are continuing to deliberate on how to effectively implement standards around the presence of lead in drinking water in schools to protect children. I'm hoping that they continue in that. You and I have had some good conversations. I'm hoping that they bring you in more fully in those conversations, that we can arrive at a consensus place of comfort before this session is over. Given that, I will not offer either the A-10 or the alternative.
All right. Thank you. And I think that's wise course. I think the language is kind of continuing to be tweaked and stakeholder discussions being held. And this is, committee members, this is a follow-on of legislation that we put into place last year with regards to schools testing their water for presence of lead and what happens after that testing and their plans. So, anyway, I don't think it's quite ready yet for committee consideration, and so I do hope that we'll continue to have discussions and that stakeholders will come and speak with the chair about some of those discussions and where we're at. So I know the department's been involved in some of that as well. So we will continue those discussions. Let's see. Then I have the A-18 amendment, and I think that's yours, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved.
All right. Representative Moran moves the A-18 amendment. And to your amendment, Representative Moran.
So, Madam Chair, my hope is that I can offer a technical amendment to the bill on line 3.17, and that would change the 2019 date to 2020. And what that would do was make certain that there's no fiscal year 19 cost to the amendment.
All right. Okay. So, Representative Moran, it's my understanding that provision that you want to take out is a drafting error. Staff has discussed that too. I think maybe for the purposes of because if we officially amend it, I really can't do that, but if we could, can we divide the amendment?
Yes.
I think we could divide the amendment in such a way that you avoid the fiscal year 19 expenditure problem with your amendment. And I'll ask nonpartisan staff. I think it's after 2.7. If you divide the amendment after lines 2.7. To line 3.17. So the rest would be. So if you agree to, if you want to agree to divide the amendment and then withdraw the first part, and nonpartisan, are you tracking this? Does that work?
No, Madam Chair, the line numbers would line up to do that. It's your decision as the chair about how to handle the division.
Okay. So, well, let's go to the division so everybody understands what that would be, and then you could decide if you want to do that, Representative Moran.
Thank you.
So it would be... So the amendment would be divided at 2.7, after 2.7?
Yes.
After 2.7.
Through 3.17.
Through lines 3.17. Right. So then if you wanted to withdraw the first part, and that would be up to line 2.7, I think that takes care of your basically blowing the target issue with that. So I just wanted to confirm that with staff.
Madam Chair, as I understand the action of the committee, by removing that section of the bill, what would remain then is the increase in participation starting in 2020 for the VPK program, but what would be absent is the language on lines 2.24 to 2.27 that's unrelated to the VPK issue, the voluntary pre-kindergarten issue. So that change would remove that from the bill, but would still essentially have the 7,160 participants in the VPK program starting in fiscal year 20. So there would be a cost in the tails, but no cost in the current biennium.
Correct. All right. Is that clear for you, Representative Moran?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
And I can accept that.
Okay. All right. So Representative Moran does divide her amendment. Does anybody want me to go over the line numbers again? Are you good? Okay. So, and Representative Moran, would you like to withdraw the first portion of your amendment up to line 2.7?
Or withdraw as divided.
Or withdraw as divided.
Okay. Yes.
All right. So Representative Moran withdraws as divided. And... All right, so now Representative Moran is moving the remaining portion of her amendment, so from lines 2.8, or excuse me, from lines, that's right. Right, so, okay. All right, so you are moving the portion that deals with extending the VPK and School Readiness Plus in 2020 and beyond.
Which is what I would like to do.
Okay, so, yeah. Very good. So that is the question before us. So why don't you go ahead and talk to your amendment, to the portion that we're
Thank you,
voting
Madam Chair.
On. I'm sorry. That's all clear as mud now, isn't it?
So just for, so I'm going to repeat this, and you can just confirm. So for the purpose of this amendment, it eliminates the end date of the voluntary pre-K School Readiness Plus program, which was created last year, which will allow the 59 districts and charters which receive one-time funding in 2017 to continue to provide services in 2019-2020, year-end and beyond. Can I get a confirmation from?
Madam Chair, Representative Moran, yes. The 7,160 students, which are the current number being served, would continue to be served starting in fiscal year 20. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So, and this is the governor's proposal, as I understand it, as this was drafted?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes. Okay. Very good.
Yeah.
All right. And anything else you'd like to say? Go ahead and make comments to your amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, this is the Governor's Dayton budget for a better Minnesota that would allow voluntary pre-K kindergarten and make it permanent. And so, Madam Chair and members, we have, in the last few sessions, have done a wonderful, wonderful job of investing in early learning opportunities for our youngest learners, knowing that the first 5 years of life is critical to helping kids enter kindergarten, be ready, be reading by third grade. You know, all the research and data tells us that that is possible, that we can see better outcomes for kids in school and in life. And so I just want to validate the importance of that. And I know from leadership that it has been a priority for you guys to make that investment, recognizing that the most neediest kids need to have that access. So I would like to just talk about, you know, we know that in my notes it says that 4,000 kids each year will have access to early learning if we can put some money in a basic continuous program. And I know within my own district there is 227 slots that is at risk. And these are schools with very high poverty and some with the most highest homeless and highly mobile populations in the districts. And others serve like EL students and special education students. And I know it's our intent here within the education committee to work towards really creating great outcomes for our kids. And it really starts in these early years. And, you know, I'm just really advocating from not pulling the rug from under these parents, from under these families who are now getting access to pre-K, voluntary pre-K services, and allow this access to continue on so that we're not just looking at today, but we're looking into the future, into the outcomes that we want to see for every child in our public school system. So I am introducing this amendment with the hope that I can get the support from this body to continue this funding that I know not only Governor Dayton is elevating, the work we've done here in this committee, but when I talk to parents from around my district and, quite frankly, from around the state, this is something that many are asking for. By no means do we know that early learning pre-K, when it's not free, is affordable. And many families are struggling with affordability. But most importantly for me, it is creating great outcomes for kids. And I just hope that we can keep this in place to do that.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Any other committee comments?
And I would like to do a roll call. Thank you.
All right. Roll call has been requested. Representative Sanchez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to speak in support of this amendment. And as I've spoken before in committee, I think we have different ideas at this table on VPK. But I want to talk a little bit about the opportunity divide within our state. And voluntary pre-K is an avenue for early childhood learning that exists in some parts that have no other opportunities. And as we consider this, you know, I just, again, want to kind of shine a light on not all areas of our state offer the same opportunities. Again, Greater Minnesota faces child care shortages, and we don't, if those opportunities existed in other places, that would be great. But many places just don't have anything but our public schools to send their kids. And this is a great opportunity for rural students, for rural children, to get the early helps that they may need, or the opportunity to receive interventions, or at least be identified if helps are needed, giving them the best start. And really my goal is to talk about all of Minnesota students, not just the ones that live in areas that have multiple opportunities. May not be perfect again, but this is one avenue that exists throughout the state that allows for our students, and we do have an opportunity divide. It exists. So I would appreciate your support.
Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question gets back to the divide. I just want to make sure that, I have this correct. So we the division is after line 2.7 through 3.17. So are we considering 1.1 through 2.7 and 3.18 through 5.23? Is that what we're considering? We essentially lopped out that middle piece?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Other Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we fail to act today, 59 school districts will lose funding. So families in 59 school districts who've got a child in a pre-K program this year and have a little one right behind will find that the opportunities that are there for their 4-year-old today are not available for their 3-year-old. And the neighbors will find that that cute little 3-year-old just doesn't get to go to a pre-kindergarten program. Governor Dayton wisely last year proposed a universal program. All 4-year-olds would have access to the same level of opportunity. I was intrigued recently to come across not only University of Minnesota research that supports the importance of a universal approach to pre-kindergarten, but a Dartmouth economist recently found that a universal approach to pre-kindergarten opportunities was not only the most cost-effective approach, but yielded the best outcomes for low-income kids. We need to move forward on a program that gets all the kids on the bus. And we know the wheels on the bus go round and round, but we need them particularly to go round and round in those neighborhoods and for those kids that are going to lose out. And students and families in 59 school districts need to know that this opportunity will be there for the younger siblings of the kids who are there today. So I would encourage a yes vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. Any other? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to highlight that I did attend Representative Pinto's prenatal forum that he had this past week, and it was very interesting. There was a researcher that did talk exactly about what you're saying, and you're right. Those low-income kids really benefited from having the early childhood education. The results were off the chart, and they were also ongoing. They didn't just, you know, they went to up to age 3 even or 4, and then they continued to have the progress as they went through the regular school system. However, they didn't see the same improvements with what I'll just call like sort of the mainstream or the rich kids. And they did not have, they did fine in school, but they didn't have the growth and they didn't have the robust improvements that the low-income kids had. So that's, you know, what I took back from that. It was by making investments in those at-risk kids, that makes a lot of sense. And for the parents who can afford it, we might be better off utilizing our resources, making sure those at-risk kids get the resources they need and make sure we have them in with waiting lists. That's why I struggle with this type of approach, as well as mixed delivery and making sure that parents have those choices. That was the other piece is with the scholarships, parents continue to retain those choices and so that they can best address their own child's needs with different opportunities and making sure that those opportunities still continue to exist in those communities. Thank you.
All right, we're getting close. So I would like us to get our vote in before we have to recess. Because I know there's another committee coming into this room. So I just wanted to say to make sure that the record is clear on this, that those 59 schools are not losing their funding for this coming fall school year. This program is in place for those schools, and everything's going to go forward as they have planned this fall school year. But we operate in 2-year budget cycles here in the legislature, and we provide a budget for 2 years. And many things have to be reauthorized and programs adjusted and funded every 2 years. And it's no different with this particular one. And so while I understand the governor and maybe others want to create a what I think is perhaps a false sense of urgency around this and concern among parents in those districts. This is a decision for the next legislature as part of the next budget that can be made when the next legislature convenes. As long as the budget's in place by July 1st, there's ample time for this discussion to occur. So, and I think it's very clear that we have demonstrated a strong commitment to quality early childhood programs and programs targeted to kids who need it the most because they benefit the most and they show the most progress, and that is an important component of our efforts to help close the achievement gap. So I just want to say publicly that nothing diminishes my ardent support for that. We'll continue that. Again, I have concerns. We have budgets. We have targets. We have constraints fiscally that we have to meet, and authorizing a program before we have to when it's part of next year's budget discussion, I just don't think is necessary. So I'm going to vote no, and with that, I would ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Lowe?
No.
Representative Bennett?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Anselmo? Representative Erickson?
No.
Representative Juergens?
No.
Representative Kreshet?
No.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Markwart?
Yes.
Representative Moran?
Yes.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Nornes?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poston?
No.
Representative Sandstedt?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Slocum? Representative Smith? Representative Tice?
No.
And Representative Thiessen? Representative Wills?
No.
So we have 6 ayes and 11 nays. The amendment is not adopted. All right, members, we are now a little bit over our time, so we will be recessing 5:30 or subject to call of the day. All right, good evening, everybody. Education and Finance Committee will reconvene and hopefully complete our business in not too long a fashion, I hope. So let's see, we still had a couple of amendments yet to deal with, and so both mine. So I am offering the A26 amendment, and this is an author's amendment. I will have nonpartisan staff go through it. It's to explain it. It's a combination of technical corrections, grammatical corrections, and things from the reviser, and a couple of language cleanup items on adding a purpose statement to the kindergarten assessments. And then I am making a change to the STAR rating system in the bill, in the DE2, that would basically direct the commissioner to develop a summative rating system to be available and beginning September 1st of 2020. So pushes that out a bit. And so I'll have nonpartisan staff go through the details of what's in this so everybody can feel comfortable with that. And whoever wants to go through that. Ms. Pera?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. So as Chair Loon was saying, most of this is very technical, so I'll try to just highlight the more substantive part. And I think the first one is on line 1.6. There's an amendment to page 4. And so the change starts on line 4. And this is in the in the safe schools, in the compensatory section. And so clause 3 is what's being amended. And so as with the amendment, it would read, report using section 120B11, which is the world's best workforce, using valid and reliable data and measurement criteria, whether increased expenditures raise student achievement levels. So that's that amendment. I think the next substantive amendment is on page 2, line 5 of the amendment.
and that is goes to page 26. And this would add a subdivision, and this is the safe schools revenue section. So this amendment would add a reporting requirement, requiring a school district or charter school receiving revenue to annually report safe schools expenditures to the commissioner. And the report shows spending by functional area and aligned with the revenue uses under subdivision 5.
And I'll suspend for just a minute. Committee members, you might remember when we did our hearing on safe schools and we were trying to determine from information available from the department, from nonpartisan staff, how schools were spending that. They don't really report that in any particular way. So I thought since we're increasing pretty substantially our funding in this, it might be nice or informative for the committee, not just nice, but informative to know how schools decide to spend this. And so we're asking them to report that back to the department.
Madam Chair, members, the next substantive change, you go to is the amendment page 2, line 20. And those are amendments on page, I'm sorry, yes, line 20, then page 35 of the DE. And that change is in the new health standards language. And so there's a few changes there. And on line 8 of page 35, the sentence would read, child sexual exploitation prevention instruction must be consistent with the definition of sexually exploited youth. So it's replacing the word assault with exploitation. And then on line, it's also adding clause 3. So on line 12, where it says the school district is encouraged to include in sexual assault prevention instruction, there would then be 3 items after that colon. Item 2 would be amended to read age-appropriate strategies and techniques to recognize and report sexual abuse, assault, or exploitation. And 3, age-appropriate information to deter boundary violations and unwanted forms of touching and contact. And then the next substantive change is on page 59. And so if you're following on the amendment, that's page 3, line 8. And this is these are changes to the rating system. So subdivision 1 would have a new headnote there. It would be rating system rather than commissioner duties. And paragraph B would read, each district, school site, and charter school must be assigned a summative rating based on a score on a scale of 0 to 100. That would be a whole paragraph. And then paragraph C would read, the summative rating must be based on what is in on the amendment on line 19. So the summative rating must be based on the accountability indicators used in the state plan to identify schools for support and improvement, and then define state plan as the state ESSA plan. Including state goals. And then and then paragraph D would read, the rating and score of each district, school site, and charter school must be reported on the Department of Education's website as part of the commissioner's school performance reports pursuant to Section 120B36 by September 1, 2020, and annually thereafter. So the change is substituting where it said SCAR before. It will now say summative rating, and that there's still a score on a scale of 0 to 100 that the commissioner is developing the rating system. Paragraph E is the same, and then subdivision 2, rather than definitions, will now be a report requirement, which will read, you'll see the language on line 9 of page 3 of the amendment. And it requires the commissioner to report on progress for developing the rating system required under subdivision 1 to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with jurisdiction over kindergarten through grade 12, no later than February 1, 2020. So there's, in 2020, there's a report early in the year, and then by the fall, the summative readings being posted. And then the rest of that rating section is deleted. The definitions are all deleted in Subdivision 2, and then Subdivisions 3, 4, and 5, which had the components for primary school, secondary school, and districts, are all deleted. And then because the this section included a definition of academic growth rate, then there's a few, there were a few other places scattered in a couple of other sections that used that definition. So that's being changed rather than saying academic growth rate, rather than being as defined in section 120B355, it's as defined in the state plan, meaning the state as a plan. The next change is, the next substantive change, I should say. You can see it on page 4 of the amendment at the bottom there. And it is on page 136 of the DE. And is amending the kindergarten readiness assessment statute by adding a subdivision. And it's the subdivision 1 purpose of assessment. And it reads, the purpose of kindergarten readiness assessment is to determine whether children are prepared to enter school, to understand the connection between kindergarten readiness and later academic achievement, and to produce data that can inform the effectiveness of early childhood programs. And then the language that's already in the DE at page 136, line 9, that'll just become subdivision 2. There's no change to that language. So even though the whole section appears in the amendment, the only change is now there's a new subdivision 1, and the existing language would be subdivision 2. And Madam Chair, that those are all the substantive changes in the amendment.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Barra. Any questions regarding the amendment? All right. Any comments from committee members on the amendment? Again, members, we spent some time talking already today about the star rating proposal in the bill and in the DE amendment, and you know, we've done some work to try to address some concerns on that. And I think, you know, this is, again, I think a good faith effort on my part to recognize concerns that have been raised, but still noting that I think that a summative rating system is still a good idea. We heard in testimony over 40 states have a summative rating system. But what we're asking or proposing is that we allow the commissioner more latitude to just develop this rather than crafting our own, and to report to us as a legislature by February of 2020 on what that is, and then implementation in September. So there'd be time for the legislature to weigh in and offer comments on that. So, and the rest, I think, is pretty perfunctory, mostly language cleanup and some other things. So if no questions, I'll go ahead and call the question on the amendment. All in favor of the A26 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Amendment is adopted. All right. And finally, I have the A23 amendment. And this amendment deals with, and I'll, if you have questions, obviously I'll direct them to nonpartisan staff, but I think it's pretty straightforward, so I'll take a crack at explaining this myself. We do have a fund transfer, and we heard it was offered in a separate bill. We heard testimony on it for the Minnetonka School District with their community education funds, and for specifically for their purpose of designing, constructing, furnishing, and equipping an early childhood classroom addition. I have been approached by three other school districts with compelling need to do this, and so I have included those three other requests in this amendment. So the Minnetonka is just in here because it's a section of the bill, but it's not changed. So. And those are Ivanhoe, Minneapolis, and Hopkins. So I think that is fairly self-explanatory. With that, I did have conversation with representatives from community education that had expressed some concerns about transferring of these in fund balances, and I don't know if representatives wish to comment on that at this time. I know we don't normally allow testimony, but because this is a little bit of an issue of concern for them, I wanted them to have the opportunity to say something.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dosland, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Community Ed Association. Generally, the Minnesota Community Ed Association has opposed fund transfers. This issue hasn't actually come up for some time. We did not speak to the Minnetonka fund transfer due to the nature of the fund transfer request, and as a result of the fund transfer request supporting community ed programs, MCA kind of nuanced their position a bit. And so MCA generally opposes fund transfers unless the funds are going to be used within community ed programs. So in the case of Minnetonka, it's to build an early ed addition. And we do have concerns about the other two fund transfers that are included in the bill. You know, I think fund balances, we have fund balances in place for a reason. School districts and companies and individuals, we all have our own savings account. It's good financial management. There are some legitimate reasons why a school district would have a fund balance in their community ed fund, just like a legitimate reason why they would have a fund balance in their O1 fund. I just wanted to point out that I think the Minnetonka fund transfer request, the finance director indicated that there are no state funds that are part of the fund balance reserve, that it's usually from user fees. So often the school district would have a fund balance in their community ed fund because they generate user fees through adult education or through school-age child care or other reasons. In many cases, while their fund balances, like in Minneapolis, the case, the fund balance might look quite large. In the case of districts, they might be saving money for a project or expanding their program, which my understanding is that's the case in Minneapolis. I just want to point out, too, I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear this, that there was a Morris-Leatherman study that showed, when compared to non-users, community ed program users are likely to rate the quality of education provided by their school district higher. They're more positive about their school district's financial management. They have favorable impressions of the school district, the superintendent, and the board. They're stronger supporters of referendums, and they're more informed about their districts. We do have concerns about the financial impact that allowing districts to transfer funds from their community ed fund balance would have on community ed programs. I do just want to point out in the case of the specific situation with Minneapolis, and I've spoken with Representative Dabney and Representative Thiessen, my understanding is if the up to $5 million was approved, that would wipe out the fund balance account. And the reason why they have the fund balance in place there is they are planning on expanding their adult basic education and their school-age child care program. So we do have concerns about the financial impact that would have on Minneapolis, but specifically just generally statewide in community education. So I apologize, it's late and I'm a little tired today. So I also did approach Representative Loon and did talk with her. You allow one fund transfer. I think just in a week, you've seen three other fund transfer requests. I think if you continue down this path, you will continue to get individual school district fund transfer requests. And as a result, I did have a conversation with Representative Loon and proposed the Minnesota Community Education Association talking about the issue and trying to see if we could come up with some flexibility to allow a statewide solution, provide some flexibility. I can't tell you what that would look like, but I'm committed to talking with them and coming up with some possible suggestions for the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Dosland. Any questions for Ms. Dosland? Representative Dabney?
Madam Chair, this is not a question for Ms. Dosland. Just assurance to you and the committee that my understanding of the community education fund balance in Minneapolis is different than hers. So were they to take the full $5.5 million that is authorized here, there still would be a notable amount of revenue left. They've been prudent and built up fund balance, which I generally support, and then there's times when you dip into fund balances. That's what they're there for. I think I can also speak for my district that they value community education programs, as do the residents, whether it's ADE or ECFE or ballroom dancing.
Thank you. Other Representative Sandstead.
Thanks, Madam Chair. This also is not for Ms. Dozlin, but can you say any more about the Ivanhoe School District? This is just going into undesignated general fund.
Yes, and I'll also allow if nonpartisan wants to add in, but Ivanhoe is a very, very, very small school in southern Lincoln County. It's southern Minnesota, almost into South Dakota. And they have been struggling for some time, and I won't get into the whole history of that school district and other circumstances, but yes, they are in a cash-strapped position and have asked for this flexibility with their fund balance as well. Do you know how many pupils are in the Ivanhoe School District, Mr. Strom? When I said small, I just wanted to give members a sense of how small.
Madam Chair, members, for fiscal year 19, we're expecting Ivanhoe to have 149 students in total in all grades.
All right. Well, if we have any other questions, thank you, Ms. Dolzen. And we did have a good conversation. I have to tell you, members, and I have talked to both Representative Thiessen and Representative Dabney, and I know that there is a difficult situation going on with the Minneapolis School District and their budget right now, and loss of staff and that. And again, that's not necessarily something we have to address, but this is something that they have requested to come forward. And then Representative Ann Somel had spoken to me about Hopkins School District and the Ivanhoe School District's Representative Schumacher. So I didn't leave anybody out who had approached me. I would say if anyone's thinking about it, the door is closed once we're finished with this markup today. But I am sensitive to the fact that these have been quite rare over the years, like very, very few cases. And I think one of the last ones we did was for a district in statutory operating debt. So they're not done lightly. And I do think perhaps it might be a good idea to develop some kind of parameters around this. I mean, obviously, when schools are maybe have either a severe funding crisis or maybe just a really great purpose they'd like to do. I think the Minnetonka one was kind of an exciting purpose with the early childhood program they're building there, and they were able to do it, and they've collected a lot of fees from their community education program participation. So I don't want to make it so restrictive, but on the other hand, we don't want schools to feeling like that this is a piggy bank to raid either with community ed. So. And I don't think that's the case with any of these requests. Otherwise, I wouldn't have included it in this amendment. So, any Representative Sandstead?
Thanks. I think I know the answer, but I'm just not going to assume. None of these schools are in SOD, are they?
No, not to my knowledge.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
None Thank you.
Apparently. Any other questions or comments? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the A23 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, the amendment is adopted. All right, and that is the end of the pre-filed amendments. I do want to offer another oral amendment. And this is pertaining to an amendment that was adopted earlier today. So I am moved to amend the House H. I'm tired, too. I can't speak today. The H-32-432A, thank you, DE-2 amendment as amended by making the new language that was added by Representative Marquardt's amendment, the A-17 amendment, to change the effective date so it would begin fiscal year 2022. So I am offering that amendment. Discussion. Okay. Representative Marker.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So that would be delaying it 2 years from the original.
That's correct.
So it's taking it out of the next biennium.
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I would rather keep it where it is. I mean, I think it's a vital. I mean, it'd be important if it was done this year, but I certainly appreciated you accepting that earlier in 20. But I think in two more years is too late to start that. So I appreciate what you did earlier, but I would be opposed to that amendment. So.
Yeah, I understand that, Representative Marquardt. I'm hoping that next year in the budget cycle that there will be money to be able to do that and move it up, but it will still have the force of law, so it will still occur in 2022 regardless. So, and that will be factored into the forecast. So. Other comments? All right, seeing none, all in favor of the oral amendment to change the effective date to fiscal year 2022, again on the A17, this was the Marquardt Amendment on the special education funding. Please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
No.
All right, in the opinion of the chair, the ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. All right, so I will move adoption of House File 4328 of the DE2 amendment as amended. And we will go ahead and go to closing comments. Oh, adopted? Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. All right. So I'm going to move adoption of the House File 4328 DE2 amendment as amended. All right. So now we're voting on the entire DE2 amendment as amended. All right. Any questions, comments? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right. Thank you. DE2 as amended is amended and approved. And now we will go to closing comments. Representative Debney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm probably going to be a little long-winded. My apologies. We'll see how, if my voice allows.
We'll go as long as your voice holds up.
All right. Could be 15, 20 seconds. I don't know. First, let me thank you for the way you've conducted the committee this year. As Representative Crescia said last night, we live in different times. We convened just after the Parkland shooting. And I think this committee has carried the weight of that shooting on our shoulders. I want to thank you for the way you've handled much of that discussion. We've had a good conversation about school safety in this committee. We moved smartly beyond the NRA's frame of arming teachers and armed guards at every school. On a bipartisan basis, we discussed, and you've included in this bill, provisions providing tools in districts, the tools that they need to harden the buildings, as they must, but also, again, and to post school resource officers if they choose. As importantly, on a bipartisan basis, again, you and we have supported, and you've included other tools to allow schools to hire more student support services, and that's key. That's good. We all want kids to be safe at school. But there is an amendment that wasn't seen tonight, and I want to take a moment on that as well. I think we all want kids to be safe at school, but I think we also want them to be safe at the movie theater and the shopping mall and in their place of worship and the concerts they go to. We want them safe walking to school, and we want them safe from their own darkest impulses. For that, we need to do more. At a minimum, we need to assure Minnesotans what they want to know, which is that only those legally allowed to possess a weapon are able to purchase one. This isn't new or dramatic or extreme. There's a long bipartisan recognition that felons and those with a history of domestic violence should not be allowed to possess guns. To assure Minnesotans that, we need to have criminal background checks on all gun transfers. Any number of states have done this, and we have not. We already require background checks, but we need to close the private seller loophole. This proposal to close the private seller loophole and require criminal background checks on all gun transfers is a bipartisan proposal in this legislature, in this House, in the Senate, and even in this committee. It's common sense, and it's broadly supported by recent polling of Minnesotans, including 89% of gun owners. Let me repeat that. 89% of gun owners support requiring criminal background checks on all gun transfers. No matter where they buy the gun, and no matter whom they buy the gun from. Last night, within the time frame that you had established, in a rushed time frame to not to accommodate the public, but to accommodate the next committee, I submitted an amendment to do just that. You caught a significant drafting error. I should have caught it. You are now using the rules that you created to deny that amendment a hearing and to deny Minnesotans an opportunity to know where their legislators stand on keeping guns out of the hands of criminals and domestic abusers and to keep children safe. This is a pattern of your party, which has blocked consideration of this proposal in both the House and the Senate this year. I understand you get to do that. I just question whether you should. The failure of this legislature to act on meaningful, bipartisan gun violence prevention is disappointing. After Parkland, the Florida legislature acted quickly. We've already had school shootings in Minnesota, as Dr. Nolan testified, Ricori, and Red Lake. I pray that we don't wait until we have another school shooting in Minnesota before this legislature acts. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Is from other members? Right? I'm going to make one, so I'm just offering anyone the chance before I speak. Representative Erickson.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I want to thank you on behalf of the Policy Committee and the members of this table for your diligence in guiding us through a small target that you have used just to the best of our ability to provide school safety. And I just applaud you for the innovative ideas, plus those that you've taken from the governor's suggestions and from others, because I think what we've done in this proposal is really say to our schools, we want to provide safety for our children and for our staffs and for all those who enter. And that's what we're called to do. We're called to set education policy. And so I think the proposal that you have within this omnibus bill is just doing a great service, not just, but is doing a great service to our state. Furthermore, there are other proposals that you've included in here that are going to certainly hold up the great teaching that goes on in our classrooms and the learning that we want from our children in different proposals that came forth from policy and also from your interest. So I thank you for that and for all the hours of work and for all the hours of work from staff. Mr. Withers, I know how hard you work. I want to thank Casey and Kelly as well, who are our right hands as in policy and in finance, and to nonpartisan staff, because we spend a lot of hours with them and really appreciate the input they give us so that we have, you know, a really great perspective on how to create just the best policy for our children of this state and to ensure that we are providing a top-notch education.
And I want to thank Commissioner Castelius because she and I have met a lot, and I know you've met a lot with her and with her staff. And I really enjoy learning her perspective and trying to come to consensus on ideas that also are going to provide the best possible education for our children and a safe setting for our children and our teachers and other staff. So, Madam Chair and your staff, thank you very much. I look forward to moving this bill further and to encountering the Senate file. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Any other comments from members? Representative Krishna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I echo everything Chair Erickson said, and I know the hard work that comes out of the policy, and I won't reiterate that. A couple of things I think is important, having cut my teeth in education in Ivanhoe, I know how difficult it is and what they're going through, and thank you for that. If you've read Sir Walter Raleigh's book, you know that your heart is always in Ivanhoe. And so with that, I know you've put a lot of work into this, and I know the countless hours you've spent on the school safety as well as the thoughtfulness of all the policy, and I think that needs to be commended as well as recognized. And I'm happy to let Minnesotans know where we stand on. And for that, I'd request a roll call vote.
Okay. Roll call has been requested, so we will have a roll call. Representative Mariani.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for, frankly, some of the thoughtful ways in which we've approached in this committee some of the issues that came to us as this bill moved along. That's what the committee process is supposed to do. And so I think it's important, regardless of you know, what the product is and, you know, who's, you know, holding a gavel, that we're following a process that builds on, that listens, that adjusts, and that adapts. Ultimately, that's good governance if we do that, as opposed to, you know, simply holding a position that we held on day one when we walked into this legislature. Reality doesn't work that way, and neither should legislation. I do think that just a couple of very quick things. One is I do want to remind members this pending issue with the Pelsby Board. We have time, to still address that issue in this legislative session, and I look forward to working with you and others to do that, because it's vitally important that we get that right. I just feel like I have to say this, and this is not directed at you individually, Madam Chair, as much as it is, quite frankly, to the leadership in this body, and then, frankly, all of us. And, you know, I was thinking about as we were looking at these fund transfers, there are, I think, certainly legitimate reasons that stand by themselves on why we may need to do those kind of things. I am taken by the Ivanhoe situation in particular because that's a really small, sparsely populated part of the state. But, you know, for me, it really does beg a bigger question about why school districts like Minneapolis is struggling the way that they're struggling financially. And, it's important for us to properly fund our schools. And, you know, we've got a special ed cross-subsidy north of $800 million. That is just eating many of our school districts alive. My school district in particular, I represent Dabney's school district, just in terms of the sheer numbers, but even if you're a small school district, it's a substantive hit. I think this legislature ought to be responding better than what we're doing on that issue alone. And so I really wish that I was voting for a bill that was making some real strong headway on that issue. And unfortunately, We don't have that before us. It does some good things. I guess my expectations are bigger, and I think the people of Minnesota's expectations are bigger as well. And again, I don't want you to take any personal umbrage on this. You know, it's the nature of the decision-making in this body that goes beyond who's in this room. And frankly, it's been a very poor decision, you know, to give us a bill of this size, given the incredible need that exists out there for many of our school districts who are really struggling just to keep classroom instructors in their classes right now. So, Madam Chair, I thank you for a few minutes to share my my concern. At the same time, I also want to thank your leadership for how you've managed this session in this committee.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Other comments? Anyone else want to speak? All right. Well, thank you, members. I want to thank you all for what is always excellent discussion within this committee. We try to make sure that we cover pretty thoroughly and across the waterfront many issues that are important to our schools, that we take this also as learning opportunities. I think we're all lifelong learners and learn more things about this very interesting and I would say very, very complex system of education finance that we have, and we learn a lot along the way. You know, coming into this session or earlier before we started our February session, I wasn't sure how much effort would be going into a supplemental bill and what we'd be doing with that, but clearly the topic of school safety being a very important one and a heightened one. I think we did very good work, and I'm very proud of every member of this committee and other members of this body who brought forward ideas, the governor who brought excellent ideas to the table. We took basically the best of all of them and put them in this bill with the money that we are allotted, and that was virtually almost all of that, $30.2 million is there, and as I look across what's been proposed in that, I think we are really at the high water mark with all of the proposals that we've put forward that will be moved at least through the House. And so I'm very proud of that, and I think we can all be proud that we are standing strong to say we are here to be supportive of our students, of our schools, and this is not just about making schools' facilities safer, but I think even more importantly is that addition of money for support staff, for mental health counseling, for those things that we know to be truly important. And it was very important to me that that money be ongoing, which it is. This will not be one-time funding to address a few needs and then move on as people's memories fade. This will continue, and I think this is very, very important, probably the most important thing that we will do this session. Not that other bills moving through aren't, but I think this is really important and a statement that we have been listening to our schools, that we have been listening to students, to teachers, and saying we need extra help, we need extra support for our students. And so I hope this is putting us a step forward in that direction. I'm sorry that some really good proposals that were brought to us couldn't be included, and those decisions are incredibly difficult. I'm sure you all understand that. But that is, unfortunately, the decisions that we have to make. But, you know, next year will be another year, and we'll have a chance to look at those really good ideas again as we move through the process. Representative Dabney, I know that you are very disappointed that we didn't have a debate and consideration of your amendment. And I will address it only in saying that when I rolled out the safety package, which was included in this legislation, and that I made public comments about the fact there are many people who want to continue to talk about other things to make us safer, whether it's background checks or other items, pointing to who has access to firearms and whether they should or not, and that. And I fully expect those discussions are going to continue, and they should continue. Our role in this committee, and I think an important role in being effective legislators is to start with how we can find some common ground and coalesce around that and take a step forward. If we continue to focus on things that maybe are more divisive and harder to get to, not that we don't still strive for finding agreement on those things, but we get nowhere. So I'm hoping this is an important step that brings us together around things that are important, things that we can all support, and I fully expect those decisions are going to continue. These are hard topics to grapple with, and this is outside the scope of really education finance, but we've had other instances where a tragic school shooting has happened. Sandy Hook happened, a couple of years ago when the composition of this legislature was different, and there wasn't major changes to our gun laws made at that time. And I say that only because no matter who's in charge politically, these are difficult topics that weigh into constitutional rights, and they're difficult for members on both sides of the aisle. And so it is upon all of us to continue having discussions and finding ways to develop common ground and for the good of all of our students and our society. So with that, I want to thank you all very much for your contributions to this and to every piece of legislation we do. And with that, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 4328, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Taxes with instructions to the reviser and nonpartisan staff to make all necessary and appropriate technical conforming formatting revisions for both the bill and the appropriations and levy spreadsheets. And a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Loom.
Aye.
Representative Bennett.
Aye.
Representative Dabney.
Aye.
Representative Anselmo. Representative Erickson.
Yes.
Representative Juergens.
Yes.
Representative Kreisha.
Aye.
Representative Mariani.
No.
Representative Markward.
Yes.
Representative Moran. Representative Murphy.
Yes.
Representative Nornes.
Aye.
Representative Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Poston.
Yes.
Representative Sanstead.
Yes.
Representative Scott. Representative Slocum. Representative Smith. Representative Tice.
Yes.
Representative Thiessen. Representative Wills.
Yes.
I get to dance by myself for a while.
There being 14 ayes and one nay, the bill is adopted. All right. With that, unless there's anything else for the good of the order, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.